The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, and welcome to our Dharma practice day. And I think most of you know this is the middle of a series for the year on the five hindrances, and the five hindrances being sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt. And today we're starting with aversion or ill will, and we'll do 2 days today and then a day in January to look at this infamous quality. And before I kind of want to give a background a little bit for the hindrances and for this particular one, I thought it might be nice to hear from you right away. How would you, having done this little exercise, how do you characterize aversion or as being different than something, just unpleasantness or preference with Ursula?
Okay, the first two categories was just the unpleasantness, and I found this was something very immediate. I felt right in my body, and no story about it. And also the wish that it be gone. I just said, drop that thought. But then the aversion started spinning out more. I lost myself in saying, if only that person, or, you know, and I found I was getting away from what was actually happening.
Great. So unpleasantness is actual immediate.
Yes.
The simple wish for it to be away was easy to drop. It was not, yeah. But the aversion caught you.
Right.
And you spinned off with it.
Yeah.
Great. Do you want?
I found this exercise to be just perfect. I just had a lot of immediate response to it. My story is that I was waiting for a result from a blood test that I had done, doctor's report, and I sat with each of these states, and
you have to hold it closer.
My immediate response to your suggestion that we identify with the aversion part to see how it feels is that that was the one where I suffered.
So aversion has the suffering. Thank you. Someone else? Yes, Ed?
I noticed three distinct categories of the experience. And while the unpleasantness seemed to be more at the point at where it was unpleasant, and the preference, I think someone else said it was easy to drop. It was just, oh, yeah, I preferred that. But the aversion, there was definitely a real active kind of putting myself in there. It's like, oh, I want this to stop. And I was a little pushing away the kind of feeling that I really got. It was very much more, grasping kind of thing.
So grasping is part of it, kind of
yeah,
getting into it.
Onto the preference.
Great. Okay. Good. Thank you. Gail?
Yeah. Is that on now?
Yeah.
Okay. What I noticed was compassion was present more with one than the other, and that was with the preference. With both the unpleasantness and just the preference, I could have, and I did feel compassion for just that being there. And then with the aversion, it didn't seem available. It was, I'm lost in it to such an extent that it's just a pushing, and I don't seem to have any control, a pushing away, and I'm not aware enough to.
Great. So there's much less
to bring
room.
Bring the compassion, I guess.
So much less room or no room at all for compassion when you're involved in aversion. That's a pretty good lesson. Good. So, Victor?
I noticed there's a pretty stark element of when there's aversion,
elements of self were involved. And when it was just pleasant and unpleasant, it was very matter of fact.
Great, thank you. So self involved. So back here by the entryway there, behind Ed.
I had more difficulty differentiating between noticing what was unpleasant, hoping, or not hoping, but sort of wanting it to be different, but knowing it couldn't be, and then the unpleasant stimulus was discontinued. It had a lot to do with the stuff happening.
Oh yeah, so
people settling in, and
so it's hard to study it then.
Yeah, and I don't know at what point it switches from unpleasant to aversion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's something to study, to look into, because I think that separation, that distinction, is really crucial. And it's easy to get them confused, and that's part of the reason why I'm doing this, is often people are confusing or entangled those two. And so they think that something's unpleasant, and unpleasantness is almost synonymous with aversion. And if that's the case, then the only hope is to get rid of the unpleasantness. If you tease them apart, then there's a possibility of freedom. Yes, Ed?
Yeah, going along with that, what I noticed is I noticed, shuffling around, and that in itself was not unpleasant. But then I experienced sometimes aversion, and that was, there wasn't anything unpleasant, but I was still experiencing aversion. So there was a definite separation between the two, hearing mm-hmm. Shuffling.
Great, thank you.
What I noticed about aversion was three things. One was that there was more thinking, even just a sentence or two more thinking. There was urgency. And I think the urgency contained a feeling of volition, like I wanted to do something.
Great. So thinking, urgency, and wanting to do, wanting to act, gearing up.
One more quick thing that I felt in the aversion was also a lot of guilt because I shouldn't be feeding this.
So for you it's guilt. For you it's guilt. Someone else it's shame. Someone else is embarrassment. Someone else is aversion to the aversion. Someone else is, wow, they can relax. Finally they're talking my language here. Wow, finally, get into, wow. I'm in familiar territory now. It's comforting. all these different things could have. So for you, it's guilt.
For me, I kind of fancy myself a change agent type, that I can make the world better somehow. So aversion is, it goes right to, this has to change. Mm. And then there's plenty of suffering there, unless it changes.
And I'm responsible. And
there's no choices.
And I'm responsible.
Yes.
So aversion has this magnet to all these other things involved, and it gets to be a universe.
I know how it needs to change, versus just, it is, and it'd be nice if it were different.
Great, thank you. Pretty interesting. Yeah. We have four mics, so they can kind of be floating around.
There's five mics.
Five mics now.
Hopefully. So one of the things that I notice when I'm caught in aversion is not only the urgency, but sometimes there's this sense of it's unbearable. The wanting to get rid of it becomes so urgent that it's like, I can't stand this. I'm stuck here forever.
One of the classic stories on retreat, especially, or in meditation, maybe some of you had this experience of something painful going on, unpleasant, restlessness or unpleasantness or something, and you can't stand it anymore, and they got to ring that bell. You're about to explode. And why aren't they ringing the bell? And then eventually, they ring that bell. And then, thank God. And so you sit there and for a minute, and then you, after a minute of sitting there, you said, wait a minute. what happened? I had this knee pain that was unbearable, and now the bell rang, and I haven't moved, and it's gone. Yes?
So when I noticed what my aversion was, I created a story about it. And so, you know, instead of having aversion to the aversion or feeling shame or embarrassment, I kind of got into the story, which created a pleasurable aspect. Mm. So I had to catch myself and realize, you know, that story deep down inside is creating its own kind of discomfort in me. So I better watch the storytelling.
So maybe part of the hook for the aversion is the pleasant story that comes out of it. So, well, this is great. So, preference. So, so we'll come back to this, but I want to then kind of introduce the hindrances in a little different way than perhaps done before. The hindrances are qualities or activities of the mind which hinder. And they hinder maybe three primary things. Classically, people talk a lot that they hinder concentration. And that's one of the most common things. Then. But when the people talk about overcoming the hindrances, they don't get concentrated. The suttas don't talk about concentration developing, but rather they talk about delight. That when the hindrances drop away, then it's replaced by a certain kind of delight. Maybe we'll talk about that later. And that delight then gives birth to tranquility, which then gives birth to concentration. And part of that delight is the delight that comes with recognizing that you're no longer caught in the hindrances. So this is a very interesting point, that the absence of something is significant. It's easy to say when we do mindfulness practice, just stay with what is. That's what we kind of say. It's the rhetoric. Stay with what is, be with what is. Well, when something is no longer, then it's irrelevant, right? You just go on to the next thing. But in the teachings of the Buddha, he emphasizes the importance of recognizing, clearly knowing, that something's been bothering you is no longer there. So the hindrances are no longer, when they're absent, recognize they're not there, and in that recognition, allow yourself to feel some sense of delight or gladness or happiness. Oh, this is good. I was troubled before. They were bothering me before. They were limiting me. They were causing problems before. And now this kind of thing, like this, the splinter is out of my toe. Wow, this is good. So the splinter is out of your mind. Wow, this is good. So that sense of feeling good about it is actually beneficial. It kind of conditions or creates an environment in the mind that makes it easier than to get concentrated. So there is you're allowed to do a kind of evaluation as a result of that. The evaluation hopefully is very, very simple, like the evaluation you make when the splinter is out of your foot. So classically, hindrances are the obstacle to concentration, or one of the important obstacles. They're also obstacles to mindfulness, to insight, to seeing clearly. They kind of cloud the mind so you don't see clearly. And the third thing, which is a little bit related to the second, but I think is very important, is the hindrances limit your ability to see what is useful or beneficial for yourself and for others. You don't see your own good when you're caught in the hindrances. And the ability to see what's beneficial or good for you and what is not beneficial and good for you is one of the primary functions of investigation. Some of you know about the second factor of awakening, sometimes called investigation, but the classic kind of explanation of investigation is not just investigating things as they actually are, but being able to differentiate between what is good for you and what is not, what is helpful for you and what is not, what is skillful for you and what is not, to make a very simple distinction. So when the hindrances are operating, it's hard to see what is beneficial for you. So, you know, if you're caught in lust, you can certainly have a good view of what's pleasure for you, what's pleasant for you, but you might not see what a royal mess you're going to make for you and everyone else by acting on that lust. You don't see what's... Or anger. You know, when you're caught in anger, you might not really see what's really for your own good. And again, a person can devastate not only oneself, but to many people. So each of these hindrances obscure our ability to see what's really beneficial and for our own good. I think that's very interesting. So then they're very important to get to know. It's very important to work with them so they don't have this hindering quality. And it isn't just a matter of overcoming them so they don't operate. But I think it's also a matter of when they're there to get familiar enough with them, of what it's like to have them there, so that when they're not there, we can feel some delight. We can really feel the difference. So the more familiar you are with them and how they are, the more I think you'll feel the enjoyment of them not being there. When you feel the suffering, when you feel how we're caught in the middle of it and how we're lost in selfing, or how we're involved in thinking a lot and the sense of urgency. Wow, no longer being compelled by urgency. Or you no longer feel this act to do, this intention, caught by it, this compulsivity. It feels good. Wow, I can be more relaxed. That's nice. So to become familiar with all these things is part of what's helpful for, I think, developing the path and the practice. And then when we look at ill will, or the second hindrance, the Pali word is usually worded or spelled vyapada. You'll get a handout with it spelled out for you, vyapada. And if you look at the Pali Text Society Dictionary, that word is defined as ill will or hostility. And it's usually explained as wanting to strike at something, wanting to destroy something. And the reason I emphasize this is that the English word aversion, which is often used to translate the second hindrance, is a little bit confusing, because aversion is a relatively vague word. Most people, I think, in English have a negative association with it. If you use the word ill will, it's almost clearly a negative association. But aversion is closely connected to the word avert. To avert something. Avert means to turn away. To verve away. To turn away. To avert. And I would suggest that there are times when it's completely healthy and appropriate to avert. We're not expected to put our hand in the flames, the fire, and then, oh, I'm not supposed to have any averting. I'm a Buddhist. no aversion. I'm not supposed to have any aversion, which means I'm supposed to just keep my hand in the flame until there's no more hand and no more problem. that's stupid. You're supposed to avert your hand from the flame. And so there's a lot of things in life where it's really appropriate to avert. The dog poop on the sidewalk. You put about to step on it. Oh, no aversion. now you should have no aversion, perhaps. No hostility to the dog poo. And, you can get caught up in hostility. Who are these people who leave it there and all that? But I think to avert your foot to the side and not step on the dog poo, we prefer that. The rest of us prefer it, at least. So in meditation practice or mindfulness in Buddhist practice, it's very important to understand that there's appropriate use of averting. Oh, I'm not going to follow that train of thought. That's not useful. I'm going to turn to something else. So if aversion simply means averting, having a preference in turning away, we don't want to avoid aversion. But if aversion means ill will, then we want to avoid aversion. So there's a confusion, I think, with the use of the word. And so we have to be a little bit careful with it. Now, so that's why some people prefer to translate the second hindrance as ill will. But ill will seems to be such a narrow category, it doesn't seem to represent very well what some people call aversion. Some people can see, well, I have a tremendous aversion to that. I don't want that. But I don't necessarily have ill will to it. I don't hate it. And so it doesn't, ill will seems too narrow for some people. And so we don't have a good word in English that holds it really well. Sometimes I think aversion is probably the best word, because most people have understand that it's being this kind of suffering kind of quality of you know, to something. But I just warn you. So I'll go back and forth between using the word ill will and aversion. And you have to be sensitive that when I use the word aversion, it's really limited to the negative uses of that term. And whatever positive uses of that term there might exist, that a healthy averting away, feeling that I want to avert from that, that is being kind of, you know, that's not being included. Does that make sense? Okay? And so there's this confusion of words. It's unfortunate to kind of pick up words and language and all that, but I think we have to do a little bit. There's also then confusion with preference, with having so a feeling of displeasure in something. I don't like this. You know, I just stepped in the dog poo. I don't like it. Now, as a Buddhist practitioner, are you supposed to have no likes and dislikes? Oh, well, you know. You know, it's okay. It's all fine. I'll just kind of keep walking down the sidewalk and into that store and restaurant. You know, and then if they have problems with it, that's, you know, they should practice. You know, I think it's completely appropriate to have a certain degree of likes and dislikes, or maybe preferences. You know, I don't like this. I don't like having this dog poo there. And I think it's appropriate to stop and clean off my shoe. It's possible to have a preference, very simple preference, without being caught by the preference, without being pushed around by the preference. It's my preference not to have this poo on my shoe. I don't like having it there. But it seems that given the circumstances right now, I can't do anything about it. You know, there's someone just had a heart attack down the sidewalk, and I'm going there to take care of it and call the emergency, and, you know, and my preference about what I like and don't like about poo in my shoe is irrelevant, and what other people think about me for having poo in my shoe is irrelevant. I'm just going to take care of this. I'm not going to be troubled by it. I'll take care of it when I can. So there's going to be, I think it's appropriate to have preferences. I think in Buddhism, I would argue that in the teachings of the Buddha, we're expected to have preferences. What do you think of that? Because we have a preference for not suffering. We have a preference to somehow overcome suffering. And without that simple preference, why would you even be here? So we're expected to have preferences. It's better to be free than it is to be enslaved by your desires. It's preferable. And there's a whole series of things which are preferable. And there's a whole series of things that we might be like and don't like. Some of the likes and dislikes we have might have to do with our own peculiar physiology. I don't like olives. There's no particular reason that I can discern of why I should not like olives. I mean, there's no logical reason. I mean, except that that doesn't taste good. my wife looks at me, she thinks I'm bizarre. You know, what's this thing about olives? maybe there's some deep, deep biochemical reason that my physiology somehow reacts, and I don't know, but I just don't like them. Now, you know, I'm willing to eat olives if they show up on my plate. It's not like, you know, I don't suffer. So it's just a simple thing. So some of our likes and dislikes are peculiar to who we are. And some of our likes and dislikes are particular to the situation. This is an unpleasant situation, and I don't like it. And But we don't have to. The important thing is we don't have to suffer because we have a like or dislike. We don't have to suffer because we have a preference of how things should be. It's when we begin suffering that the practice kicks in. That's where we look at and see. And so with aversion or ill will, the suggestion is that here's a situation which we've crossed a line. It's no longer a simple preference or a simple like and dislike, but we're caught in it. There's compulsivity in it. There's suffering in it. And it obscures our ability to see clearly what's going on here. So when you sit down to meditate, for example, you do mindfulness, the simple fact that something is unpleasant does not mean that there's aversion as part of it. Some people associate unpleasantness with aversion, but we have to tease those apart. The fact that you have a preference about this also is not necessarily a problem. And you can tease that apart from the aversion or the ill will. I think if we don't tease that apart, it gets really confusing. It becomes, I have to not only get rid of my aversion, but I have to kind of somehow get rid of my displeasure over this, or my feeling of not wanting this. I'm supposed to kind of be completely equanimous and neutral and let everything be as it is and not have any wishes in regard to this. And I think that then we start shutting down some basic human qualities of who we are. And then that starts becoming a problem. And then people start acting out, or the pressure builds up in other kinds of ways, and it's problematic. So how do we hold a preference without clinging to it, without being driven by it? How do we hold it lightly? And I think that's part of the task of this mindfulness, is to tease those things apart. And then we can work with a compulsive quality of aversion, work with aversion or hostility, and free ourselves, but be left with our preferences. But then the preferences, my ankle hurts. I guess, that's okay with me. I don't like it. I wish it was different, but given what's happening, it's okay. So what do you think of that? What do you have any comments or questions about that? Yes.
So I'm seeing from this that that unpleasantness is an initial experience, something that happens that we may or may not have any choice about, may or may not be able to avoid. But aversion, the deep-seated kind of aversion is our response to the initial experience, and something that we can learn to have a choice about.
Yes, but what I was suggesting also is that in between that, the initial experience and we have choice about our response, there is also a relatively innocent response, which is a response. It's not the unpleasantness, but, I prefer this wasn't here. And so that's also a response, but I would suggest it's kind of an innocent response, or it's even an appropriate response sometimes. But then we have to have hopefully wisdom and understanding about that response. If there's aversion, chances are we don't have any wisdom about that response. We have aversion, then we relate to that choice, that preference, in a compulsive way. Or we get caught up in that world. But if we have wisdom, we see, I have a preference here. But in this time and place, it seems like acting on that preference is not going to work out. So I think I'll just figure out how to be equanimous with it.
Actually, you addressed...
Okay.
I was going to ask, how do we become...
Fine. I was going to ask how we become entwined with our simple, likes, dislikes to... full-blown greed, hate, and delusion?
Uh-huh. That's a great question, which you guys will answer later today.
Um, going back to the comment about the compassion part not being there during the aversive phase, the rather long phase, what I notice is that as I gain understanding of my aversion, the compassion returns, and that the may all beings be at peace, may all beings be well, may all beings be happy, may all beings be safe, that those thoughts, for me, are a very strong antidote, so that when I am completely caught and I cannot get out of the, you know, oh, he's wrong, oh, I'm wrong, you know, the blame and all the story, that a lot of times if I go back to compassionate feelings and fiercely stick to that, that the compassion will return, and then I can go back to studying the aversion.
Great.
And the thing, and that holes suddenly appear in it.
Great, beautiful. So, and in order to do that, you have to pull yourself out of the orbit of the aversion enough to bring this other practice in. And so there's a variety of other things you could do, but one way or the other, we have to get out of the orbit, out of being caught in it. And that was great. So what's your name? I forgot.
Marsha.
Marsha, yes.
Green. Yes. So I'm confused. Aversion to me is turning away from something that may be quite unpleasant, and that my hope is that I could look at it and go into it to understand the aversion, because I think some things are unpleasant that I need to not avert my eyes from.
Right.
So I'm confused.
And that's why I took the care earlier to make the distinction between two kinds of aversion. That there's a healthy form of averting, and there's an unhealthy form of aversion. And so when we use the word aversion, there's often a confusion in some people, just like you're making here, that you're supposed to no longer have any averting at all, or wish to avert. And I'm saying no. A healthy averting, if that involves aversion, healthy aversion, that's really good. You should be able to do that if you can, if the situation allows it. It's the aversion which, there's unhealthy aversion, where we're caught in hostility and ill will, we're caught in compulsivity, contraction, clinging, all these other things that is a source of suffering, So we have to make this. So what I'm trying to do here is making a distinction between the very thing you're concerned about. That that it's okay to have a preference. It's okay to wish to avert, to turn away from some things, and it's okay to turn away from some things. However, and so we have to be able to understand that there is this category of stuff. On the other hand, there is a turning away which is based on our ill will, our hostility, our fear, inappropriate fear, our anxiety, our sense of self, our compulsivities, our strong desires. So, it's one thing to turn away from stepping in dog poo. It's another to see someone walking down the street who is very different from you in some way or other, and say, and then just kind of avert from that person because that person disturbs you in some way. There's a lot of examples in society of averting from other people because somehow we don't like them, or we have prejudice against them. And so we have to be able to distinguish between, what's motivating it, how are we caught, and what's happening. And so when you're talking about the hindrance of aversion, we're talking about aversion when it's a hindrance. And any hindrance at all, we need to overcome. If something's hindering us, we want to stop being hindered. And I'm suggesting here this morning that it's a lot easier to do the investigation and the work of overcoming the hindrance of aversion if we understand there's a difference between a healthy averting, a healthy appropriate wishing something to be different from the way it is, and the unhealthy aversion. Because I see many people who confuse the two, and they think, oh, I'm supposed to get rid of every possible desire or wish that things be different. And so I'm supposed to sit here and just accept everything and not have any, not avert, not have any wishes for it to be different. And I think this distinction is really, that's why I want to make this distinction. So is this helpful? Does this address your concern, or did I miss you, or?
I see that the aversion that I'm confused about is the one that I may say is a preference. It's the second descriptive or the example that you gave. Turning away from an issue, turning away from a problem, not wanting to look at the poverty in the community, not wanting to that is what I see as an aversion that I need to pay attention to and look into.
Great, yes.
And I'm not sure where the hindrance comes, and I can understand the preference between, you know, wanting to walk on the sunshine side of the street or the shady side. It's the issues that concern me the most in when I feel that I am averting my eyes from a major problem.
Yeah. So one of the functions of the hindrances is to prevent us from seeing clearly what needs to be seen. And so we need to. That's why we need to bring our attention to the hindrances to overcome the way in which they blind us or hinder us. So that's the issue.
It's new language.
Yeah, it's a whole new language. Yes. So we've gotten started. We're launched into the world of aversion. And we'll come back and we'll do a little bit more discussion about this word, the Pali word and the meaning. And then we'll do some more your exploration of the topic. So let's take a break. And maybe we start in here. We started here at, how long do we need for a break? Those of you who come here before other Dharma practice days, how long is needed? Should we do 15 minutes? 15 minutes then. So we'll start again here at 5 to 11.